once more into the breach, dear friends. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. This is Jeff McClure, and this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and Jake's not here, which is a different intro than we normally do. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, another exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and McClure, only the is gone, so such is life. He got invited to a conference because he's really smart, and they thought he could add something to the conference because he had something interesting to say. And I'm in here all by myself today, which makes life sort of interesting, to say the least, and you're certainly welcome to give us a call. But before you give us a call, I have to take my clothes off, or at least disclose, which is what that means. And the thing I'm going to disclose is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not just this radio program. It is also the name of an investment advisory firm in which Jacob McClure and Jeff McClure, the two normal folks or abnormal folks that show up on this radio program, normally have something to do with. It is also the name of this investment advisory firm, and we give investment advice, but what I'm going to talk about on the air today is not investment advice. It's educational information, which is a different thing altogether. Investment advice should be given to individuals based on individual circumstances and should not be generalized, and so we don't generalize it. The stuff we talk about, the stuff I talk about on the radio today, will be obtained and has been obtained from sources we consider reliable, but we don't make any guarantees. I mean, things like the Wall Street Journal and Barron's and Financial Times and The Economist and such. And they generally tend to be pretty reliable, but you never can tell. So we don't make any guarantees about that. And let's see, is there anything else I need to tell you? Probably, but I've forgotten what it is. So the telephone number to call in here, if you would like to talk on the air with me, if you'd like to ask me any questions, and I would really love it if you did that, if you'd like to ask questions or raise any concerns or anything of that ilk, or make a comment about the economy, investing, anything of that nature, the telephone number is 254-773-1400. And I will do my best to properly answer the telephone. Normally there are two of us in here, and we kind of share the responsibilities, and I'm going to try to do it all by myself, which is kind of one of those interesting challenges in life. And we have a caller coming in already on 773-1400, so we're going to see if I can actually answer the phone. So, caller, I think you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a poor immigrant, and is there a correlation between the presidential years and the stock market? That's number one. Like, the first year it goes up and then it goes down.
There is some degree of correlation.
And the second question is what should I do with that correlation with that? I mean, is there a way to invest
No. in the market? I can answer that one, no.
All right. Okay.
Okay. All right. Thanks for calling. That is, you know, when I say that there is a correlation, but you really can't take advantage of it, it's kind of like there's probably patterns involved if you go to Las Vegas and you play cards. But unless you're a professional, and even then, you are unlikely to do particularly well, you can't really take advantage of it. And the reason I say that is there are certain correlations that show up in the market through history a certain percentage of the time, and if that percentage is over 50%, people tend to get really excited about it. For example, one of the old sayings in the market is sell in May and go away. Well, had you done that this year, you would have missed a huge run-up in the market. There are other years when things were obviously different, when in a pretty stable situation where nothing is changing, we're not coming out of a recession, and those things back in the 20th century when such things went on pretty routinely, when everything was kind of stable and unchanging, there's certain correlations that show up, and it has to, you know, that we can even figure out the cause of the selling man go away, and that is that the major traders, as soon as it gets hot in New York, used to go on vacation. And when they went on vacation, they weren't making big bets and they weren't making big buys, and they left the second string to take care of things, and they were told if it hits this price, sell it, but nothing about what to buy. So gradually the traders on Wall Street would accumulate more and more and more cash through about October. And then come the end of the year, the traders would pile back in with their money, and then we'd have what's called the Santa Claus effect towards the end of the year. And in, if you went through history, you'd find out that September and October are the worst years in the market, our worst months in the market, and October is by far and away the worst month. But if you look at October of this year, we did quite well. If you want to look at September, we did quite well. And so the market doesn't follow these patterns consistently over time. And the same thing is true of presidential tenures, if you want to call that, during the 4 years of a presidency. There are certain years that in the early first, for instance, in the first year of a presidency, the correlation is the market doesn't do too well. And the reason the market doesn't do well is because that's when the president tends to push through Congress and encourage Congress to do unpopular things that like raise taxes, cut deductions, and do things that have a negative effect on earnings. Well, obviously that hasn't happened this year. In the last 12 months, the market is up about 20%. It's up about 18% year to date. So had you followed these correlations this year, you would have missed out on a major run-up in the market. And very frankly, nothing is normal in Washington right now compared with what we've seen over the last many decades. There's polarization like we have not seen in 100 years. There's a president who certainly is outside of all of the bounds of what we consider normal presidential activities to be, to the point where the market has arrived at a point where it almost completely ignores what's going on in the White House. And that's odd because historically, the president of the United States could move the market tremendously with a comment. This president, because he makes so many comments and so many of them turn out to be other than accurate, the market basically ignores it. And that, by the way, happened on Friday. The people who are used to playing the correlations triggered a rapid sell-off on Friday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down 400 points, for example, at one point. Because of Flynn's, the announcement that General Flynn, the former advisor, former national security advisor, had pleaded guilty to a relatively minor charge, but the charge sheet, the indictment that was released, showed that he could have been charged with major criminal activity. He wasn't charged with those, even though they are on the rap sheet, if you will. And that indicates that he is cooperating with the prosecutors and has cut a deal. And whatever it is that he's whatever he has agreed to testify about or present evidence on is major, because there were some laws that he clearly broke that are fairly major criminal laws. He was acting as an agent of the Turkish government while in the federal government as an employee, and that's a felony. And he could have gone to jail for 20 years for that. Instead, the most he could get out of lying to an FBI agent is about 6 months. That historically would have generated a major sell-off in the market and would have tipped this bull market that we're in into a bear market, because that's just the way it works. But in this particular market, the entire down market lasted half a day. The Dow almost completely recovered, as did the S&P 500 by the end of the day on Friday, and is moving along nicely as it continues. The fact that the Congress, the Senate passed a, or was about to pass on Friday, a bill that included a very unfavorable to investors tax provision, in essence raising taxes on capital gains for if you're in stocks or mutual funds, would have historically caused a market sell-off. As a matter of fact, the 1987 market sell-off was at least in part, it is thought, because of the Tax Reform Act of 1986 that raised capital gain taxes. But it didn't. And we'll see what happens on Monday, but I strongly suspect it won't. And things will continue to charge along. So trying to find a correlation between something other than pure economics, well, there's two elements that move the market. Pure economics and cyclicality, which is a really fascinating word. It just means that people tend to go to excess and they tend to buy more than is wise, and when we run out of buyers in the market, even temporarily, the sellers are pretty good at smelling that, and they come in and start selling, and that causes the market to plunge because there aren't any buyers to buy the shares they're selling, and so the first people out the door generally make some pretty good money, and the last people out the door lose a lot of money. That's called a correction, and we're overdue for one. Could happen at any time. All it takes is a little pullback in the buying enthusiasm. We don't see any signs of that right now. But historically, when the market has run up this much without regard to its norm, without regard to whether it's overly valued or undervalued, we get corrections. Matter of fact, we've gone longer without a major correction than any time in my memory, which goes back to 1982 in the market. Excuse me. So trying to buy or sell in the market based on correlations that have happened in the past is, very frankly, a loser's game. And it looks like we have another call on 773-1400.
You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. One thing I've always told my daughter is, three things that you need to protect is your name, your word, and your reputation. From a financial standpoint, you know, Social Security cards and your FICO scores are two things that you also need to protect. One thing on FICO scores, and I've heard some ads lately, I've heard that in certain cases, when somebody goes in and checks your FICO, it puts, you know, actually lowers your score. And then there's some ads I've heard that when we check your credit, it doesn't. So how does that work, and why would checking your FICO score reduce it? I'm in my truck, so I'm going to hang on and listen.
Okay. Thanks for calling.
FICO scores are based on your ability. It's obviously computer-generated algorithms, but they're based on your perceived ability to pay back a loan. And if a lender, somebody who is considering, who you have applied to for a loan, checks your score, one of the things that they do is they say why they're checking your score. They just can't randomly, by the way, come in and check your score. They have to have your permission to check your score. And when they do, if they come in and say, we are considering, this person has applied for a loan, you effectively are in a position where your available credit, in other words, the FICO score says this guy, the higher your score, the more you can be loaned and still be in the ballpark within the parameters that lending authorities and regulators and inspectors want to see. So what happens is, if you have in effect announced, I'm going to borrow $30,000, then your FICO score goes down because you are about to commit to borrow more money. Now, if somebody checks your FICO score and they say it's purely for information, for example, if you check your FICO score and it's an informational request, purely informational, has nothing to do with a loan, it doesn't cause your score to drop. If you shop around for, you know, obviously what a person can do, and this is what they're trying to avoid, is if you shop around for credit cards and you contact five different credit card companies in a short period of time, then you could be in a position where you could be making a lot of borrowing in a short period of time and not be able to pay it back, and so that's why the score goes down. And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with a personal wealth coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I got cut off on my phone and didn't hear your answer, so I apologize.
Okay. Basically, the FICO score drops if a lender checks your credit. And the lender will normally state in the request what the size of loan is that you're asking for. So if you apply for a new credit card and it has a $25,000 max on it, and the company you applied to checks your FICO score, you effectively have stated, I'm using up $25,000 of my available credit. And so your score goes down, because obviously you could jump out there and apply to 10 of those at the same time. And if there was no check and balance on all those applications, then all of them might look and see you have a super high FICO score and no debt or very little debt, and they could loan you $250,000, and you could take the $250,000 and cut out with it and not pay it back. So
that makes sense, I guess. But you have to, I guess you have to give them permission that you're signing up for the credit card or whatever.
Oh yeah, you have to, when you sign an application, either electronically or otherwise, for a credit card or a loan of any kind, you give them permission to check your credit. It's in the fine print there. On the other hand, if you go to an agency that is doing this strictly for informational purposes, just to check to make sure everything's okay, they state this has nothing to do with him borrowing any more money, and that doesn't lower your score.
Okay. So one last thing: if you're, let's say, you're thinking about buying a house, and you do, and you want to try to pre-qualify,
mm-hmm.
and you say, "Hey, how much can I qualify for?" And but you're not going to pull the trigger. Would that still go against your score?
Yes. Because you are in the business of prospecting for a loan.
All right.
And
okay.
you said you have no intention of pulling the trigger. That's not on the application anywhere.
Okay, guys, enjoy the show.
Okay. Have a good day and be careful out there. Remember my motto, even paranoids have enemies.
Yeah. Well, don't drive in Fort Worth because 35 is shut down to 820 as
usual. Yeah, and let me tell you, getting into Temple this morning was an exciting. They keep moving the cheese.
Moving the cheese, all right.
They move the exits around. Okay, thanks for calling. Yeah, it's exciting around here in this part of Texas. When you try to get anywhere in the Temple area, for those of you in Temple who are getting a little frustrated with the exits moving around randomly. And you're missing exits and having to go to the next one, and the next one is not what you thought it was, and so you wind up winding in and out of construction equipment for an unreasonable period of time. We went through that for, I think, 7 years in Salado, and we only have 3 or 4 exits, and they kept shutting them down and opening them up randomly with very poor signage, and it nearly put us out of business down there. I say not the personal wealth coach, but... I think there were 39 businesses that shut down during that period of time, and there was a deep concern in the village of Salado whether we were going to survive this, because, you know, the village of Salado, one of its prime sources of income is sales tax, and we saw, I think, something like a 40% drop in sales tax revenue in Salado when all this construction was going on, and suffered accordingly, lost village staff, and so on. It's an interesting thing, the improvement in the highway in slow motion by the government is pretty inefficient in one sense, in the and that it does a lot of damage to the local businesses. But it is the least expensive as far as dollars out of pocket is concerned for the government. And that's one of the key elements in economics. Whereas if the state and federal government was willing to pay more and get the job done quickly, there's a powerful argument, and I happen to agree with it, that they'd actually get more in tax revenue that they're going to miss for doing it quickly and spending the money efficiently than they would get by stretching the payments out over many years and just paying a little bit a year and squeezing the contractor to have the smallest number of people working on it at any given moment. From a purely financial perspective, that's the most efficient way to build a highway, very, very, very slowly. From an economics perspective, it is the worst way to build a highway. Are among the worst. The worst would, of course, be build it really, really quickly and have it fall apart. But presuming that you're going to build a quality highway through a functioning community, the longer it takes, the higher the cost gets. But the costs don't go on the books of Congress. They go on the books of the businesses that fold up or don't do business. It's one of those things that putting a little pressure on our representative who has a lot to do with the highway. I think he was, and I presume he still is, on the Transportation Committee, Transportation Appropriations Committee, and has a pretty healthy input into how and fast money gets spent to build this highway. I would recommend to the people in Temple that you bombard him with complaints about the disruption. The highway construction in Salida was supposed to take 3 years, and it took 7. And Congress had a lot to do with that, and the guy in Congress who could in many ways most affect that was our congressman, and he chose to spread the money out over a long period of time and hold the deficits to a lower level rather than get the job done quickly and get the tax revenue in. So it's an interesting little phenomenon. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The number in here is 254-773-1400. It's today is the second. No, let's see. Let me. Oh, apparently December hasn't happened in here yet. This is the 2nd of December. And if that's so, where you are, you're certainly welcome to give me a call. Jake is normally here. Jeff and Jake are normally here. But Jake is off at a conference where he got a special invitation, and he went and left me here by myself. So let's talk a little bit about what happened during the week. I mentioned a little earlier something quite interesting happened, and that is that on Friday, the announcement that Lieutenant General Flynn retired took Michael Flynn, pleaded guilty to a minor, relatively minor charge, lying to an FBI agent. But his the document that was presented, the indictment document that was presented to the court associated with his admission of guilt, indicated that he had been indicted on a series of far more serious charges that would put him in prison, could have put him in prison, were they proven, for an extremely long period of time. This indicates that he is, and there is, and the both Mueller, the prosecutor, and Robert Mueller, the prosecutor, and the everyone else involved have issued statements to the effect that he is cooperating with the prosecution, and he will be making testimony. ABC reported that he's going to make testimony specifically that the President of the United States, the current President, President Trump, specifically told him before taking office to make contact with the Russians, and that's why he did it. That normally would have been the cause of a major sell-off in the market. And instead of seeing a major sell-off in the market, we saw the market dip. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 400 points, which sounds impressive, but it's like 2%. and then almost completely recovered by the end of the day, and stayed well up for the week. As a matter of fact, if you go week by week, this was an excellent week and worthy of note in every aspect. So let's look at what the market did. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 24,231. And the reason I bring up, I don't normally talk about the Dow, is I personally keep a benchmark record in my brain so I can know what's going on. The Dow crossed 23,000 and then 24,000. So I remember that a week or so ago when the Dow crossed 24,000, that was a benchmark. I'm going to remember that. It's kind of like when the S&P 500 crossed 2,500. I said that's significant. Remember it. And now it's crossed 2,600. So the S&P 500, for example, closed at 2,642 for the week. And for the week, it was up 1.53%. Year-to-date, it's up 18%, and for 52 weeks, or 1 year, it's up 20.54%. And it is in that position despite the fact that not only is there a storm cloud brewing over the White House that, for those of us who are old, we can, and who were following the news back in those days in the early 1970s, it is very, very, very reminiscent of what went on in the Nixon era after his reelection, when very gradually the rumors that he had done something inappropriate in the process of getting elected, which he denied vigorously, of course, became thicker and thicker. And finally, some of his senior advisors flipped, and flipped meaning that they agreed, rather than going to prison for a long period of time, that they would become state's evidence and testify what really happened during the reelection campaign. Ultimately, for those of you who don't remember your history very well, Richard Nixon resigned over this because it was clear that even though he was ideologically a darling of the conservatives in the Republican Party and the Republicans-controlled Congress, they reached a point where it was very, very clear that they needed to jettison Richard Nixon or they were going to go down. Does that mean it's going to happen this time? I have no idea. What I can say is that it's looking more and more like President Trump's ability to get anything done is going to be greatly diminished from this point forward. And the reason I say that is because until all the evidence is in, right now there is an assumption that that Michael Flynn was given a get-out-of-jail-free card because he has something so valuable to say, or evidence is so valuable to present, that they're willing to not hammer him to get a much bigger fish. Well, there's only a few fish bigger than him, and so the question remains open. And the reason I bring this up is not because I'm pro or anti or anything else. Trump, he's the president, and I have a tendency to go with whoever is the president because the constitutional process is the one that elected him, or her, if we ever get one. And I go with that. It isn't the perfect system, but it's the best system in the world. And there's a lot of good to be, if you want to look at it, there's a lot of good there. You can see a lot of evil there, or you can simply say this is the president and the president is doing what the president does. And I tend to be in that category. But the thing that's different this time is that when it became fairly clear that Richard Nixon was likely to be impeached or had a chance of being impeached, and the scandals got thicker, the market started down. The market in 1972 was not greatly different than it is today. It was high based from where it had been. It was
Certainly not wildly overpriced, but it was high. And a lot of things came together in the Richard Nixon's potential impeachment and resignation following his vice president's resignation after being indicted definitely was a factor in the stock market decline and recession of 1973 and 74. And most of you don't remember that, I'm sure. Many of the people who are listening probably weren't born in 1973 and 74. But it was a very real time. We were involved in a foreign war that we were trying to get out of. The president had been elected, at least on part, to get us out of the war, and it wound up digging us a little deeper into the war. If this all sounds familiar like where we are today, it's because it is. But what's different this time is that the markets are largely ignoring that. We don't have thousands and thousands. We don't have 100,000 people involved in fighting a war. We have a few hundred people involved in fighting a war. And very frankly, the market has effectively discounted at this point the impeachment of the president, which is just mind-boggling to those of us who've watched the market for many, many years. The market has said, and I'm not in any way disparaging the president, but the market has in essence said the president is irrelevant. And the reason I say that is when a major threat to the presidency pops up, as it did on Friday, and the market's reaction is to drop 2% and then recover, that suggests to me that the market, that the anything that happens on the political level is unlikely to make a big difference. There are other things that happened that were equally interesting. So that's where we are. The price of gold has been dropping for 3 months now. Is that got anything to do with what's going on in the presidential, in the White House, or anything to do with the United States economy? Probably not. And I know that sounds strange. The reason the price of gold has been dropping for the last 3 months is because people in India are selling gold. And I think that really comes down to one of the most fundamental things that we don't understand very well as American investors, in my experience. And that is that since 2000, and even more so since 2007 and 8 and 9, we are in a global economy. Those of us who are old enough to have significant money to invest still think of our economy in terms, as even the caller did when he called in earlier, still think of our economy in terms of the United States being the economy. We think of the stock market and the economy in terms of the U.S. president or what the Congress is doing in the United States. And one of the things I think we easily overlook is there's no longer one player in the market. There's four. The U.S. used to drive the train almost exclusively. There was an old saying, if the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches pneumonia. Not true anymore. It's still a factor. We're still factually one of the two biggest movers and shakers, but still there are three major economic powers, if you will, or forces, and a fourth one, which is not very well organized or coordinated, but it's there. The first is obviously the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy, the U.S. corporate earnings, U.S., 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 is a major element, but it's something less than a third of the contribution to the whole world. The European Union, or the Eurozone, or Europe, is another one. And the rise or fall of the economy in Europe has a profound effect upon the earnings of United States corporations because, frankly, we do a lot of business outside the United States. One estimate that I read recently said that about 40% of corporate earnings in the United States come from sales that occurred outside the United States. Because, face it, the biggest manufacturing firms in the world mostly are in the United States. The biggest firms in general are in the United States. That's where they're headquartered. They do business all over the world. And as the rest of the world grows economically, the rest of the world will tend to make up a bigger and bigger and bigger portion of what we see on the United States Stock Exchange and what we see in the United States economy. A growing portion of our economy, and it's already big, it's already, I think I read the other day, around 12% of GDP, which is a lot, and growing very fast. And I think that 12% is a low estimate, is based on several years ago. But about 12% of the GDP, and I tend to think closer to 20% at this point, is to do with foreign trade. Now, that's primary. The secondary effects of foreign trade probably are approaching 50 to 60% of U.S. economic activity. Now, why do I say that? If you go to Best Buy and you buy a television, well, you obviously bought the television from a U.S. company in the United States, and that should be the end of the thing. But the point is, there is that television, that flat-screen TV, is something that was produced somewhere else and was bought by Best Buy from overseas. At the same time, we're rapidly headed towards being the biggest oil exporter on the planet. And that's a bigger and bigger and bigger portion of our economy as we export oil. We also refine. We're the largest refiner on the planet as a nation, which means crude oil that's produced somewhere else is shipped here, it's refined here, and then we send it back out again. Again, that's an import and an export. And it is very crucial to our economic well-being that we keep doing that. If you drive an automobile, and these are the most obvious things, there's obviously other things too. If you drive an automobile and you bought it in the United States from a U.S. car maker at a U.S. dealer, probably something approaching half of that, of what was of the labor and materials cost of that automobile, came from outside the United States. And that's good, because we simply don't have the manufacturing capability. We don't have enough workers. We don't have enough factories. If we're approaching what the economists call full employment, so we couldn't open up a bunch of factories and hire a bunch more people because there's just not more people to hire to assemble cars in the United States. And not to mention the fact that the people who could assemble cars in the United States are frankly no longer interested in repetitive assembly line activities. There's other things they can do that are far more, far less strenuous and far more healthy for them, where they can get paid as much or more as they can on an assembly line. We have two ways we can go with that. We can either do largely as we're doing right now and as we've done in the past, and that is export the assembly. Mexico is for example, is an extremely convenient place for us to export assembly. We build the precision parts in the United States mainly. We ship them to across the board into under NAFTA into Mexico, where the cars are assembled and the finished product comes back in the United States. Well, because of the fact that there was value added to the car to get it back into the United States in that assembly, the car is worth more coming in than the parts were going out. And so we wind up with what looks like a negative balance of trade. But the key to remember in this is, for example, if it was a Ford or a Chevrolet or whatever it was, that the plant in Mexico is owned by the U.S. corporation. And the profits made by the plant in Mexico are U.S. corporate profits, and they're reported in the stock of the company that owns both the U.S. Facility that makes the parts and the Mexican facility where the parts are assembled, and in many cases has an ownership interest in the dealership where it's sold. It doesn't make any difference to that corporation, which is one of the reasons that one of the things we have potential to worry about, if you're really interested in worrying about something in the economy. If, for example, the president said, nope, we're pulling out of NAFTA, forget it, forget NAFTA, it would have every economist that I've read on the subject agrees, it would have a far more profound effect in the negative than the tax reform act that's processing through Congress would have in the positive. And the tax reform act that's passing through Congress has been estimated by some pretty reliable people. Of course, we don't know exactly what it's going to be when it comes out, to add probably 0.2% to the GDP. Is that enough to pay for the trillion or $1.5 trillion, the $1.5 trillion cut in taxes? No, according to the studies that have come out from, again, independent and as well as the Joint Committee on Taxation in Congress, the $1.5 trillion increase in the deficit or decrease in tax revenue, that activity will probably produce about $500 billion in additional taxes, which will still leave us a trillion short. So this is one of those things that is a fact. It will, the tax act as it was passed by the Senate would definitely stimulate the economy. The problem with stimulating the economy at this point, of course, is that we're already approaching full employment. It will increase the borrowing by the Treasury and will put pressure on the Federal Reserve to start increasing interest rates because it puts a bunch of money in there with not enough workers. Corporations will have to start competing for the workers, which means they're going to have to start running prices up. They're going to have to start running wages up to compete for the... It's going to be real interesting to see how this comes out, because sticking stimulus, which is what a tax cut is, into the economy when we are at near full employment and last quarter slightly exceeded our maximum sustained production capacity in the United States will be an interesting thing to follow. Well, now that I've said all of those things, it's actually time to do some commercials, presuming that I'm smart enough to figure out how to do that in here. But we're going to do a commercial break, and this is KTEM, and I'm Jeff McClure, and the telephone number in here is 773-1400. Area code 254, and we'd love to hear from you. It's 1049 on December 2nd, 2017, and we'll be back on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I normally would say with Jeff and Jake McClure, but Jake's not here today. It's 10:53 on December 2nd, 2017, and if you'd like to give us a call or give me a call in here, the telephone number is 254-773-1400, and this, of course, is the Personal Wealth Coach. It remains the Personal Wealth Coach. We were talking about the fact that the market is treating the political situation as a non-event. It's probably going to continue to do that. Then the Senate, of course, passed a tax bill. Now, I haven't had a chance to read the tax bill, but there was a provision in the proposal, and I don't know if it made it, if it was cleared out in the final bill, I hope it was, that should concern you. And that there's a couple of them. One is that in the event federal revenue appeared to drop off and thereby would trigger a deficit increase greater than $1.5 trillion, a provision would kick in that would raise taxes. Sounds like a great idea, and it was intended to keep the deficit hawks from making too many waves. The problem with that is revenues fall for the government as we enter a recession. Raising taxes while people are getting laid off and while we're entering into a recession is the kind of thing, and it did happen, that that created a depression out of a recession in the early 1930s. We talk about the stock market crash in 1929. The recession didn't actually start until 1930 and 31. But the response from Congress, the conservatives in Congress were deeply concerned about deficits. And as a result, they cut spending and raised taxes as we went into this recession. And in the process, triggered a depression. And again, they continued to fight. They continued to fight the deficits all the way to 1934, when the Republicans lost control of Congress and they lost the presidency. And they did so with the best of intent. They did so saying, we don't want to run up a big debt. It's bad to run up a big debt. But as they raised taxes and cut spending, they sucked money out of the economy and didn't send any back. And the end result was we got the Great Depression. Restricting free trade. Those are the two key elements that turned a recession into a depression. And one of those elements, the raising of taxes in if we have a recession, was inserted into the Senate proposal. And again, I have not seen the final thing that the Senate voted on last night. It's probably going to be pretty complex, and we don't know even if that, we certainly don't know that that is going to be the final bill, because the House version of the Tax Reform Act is profoundly different in many ways than the Senate version. Do I think they're going to reach a compromise? Yes. Why do I think they're going to reach a compromise? Because the Republicans who control both the presidency, the House, and the Senate do not want to finish out this year with no major legislative accomplishment. And they're going to do something good, bad, or indifferent. There is a provision in the Senate bill that will make owning investment shares in investments potentially more expensive. An effective raise of the capital gains taxation, not the tax rate, but the taxation, that I think is it's very ineffective, it's very inefficient, and I think it's generally a bad idea. I'm not at all sure it will raise revenues for the government, but it will raise expenses for people. And that is, right now, if you want to sell, let's say you have a mutual fund and you want to sell, let's say you have $100,000 in a mutual fund and you want to sell $10,000 worth of the shares. Currently, you can pick which block, you can sell a block of shares that you purchased a long time ago. You can sell one that you purchased just the other day, or you can sell a block of shares that you purchased at some other time. So what people tend to do, if they are doing this actively, and certainly we've done it in our firm for people, is we look at the block of shares that will create the least tax hit. In other words, if you bought some of the shares at $10 and some at $20 and some at $30 and the current price is $40, we would tend to sell the $30 shares to get your $10,000. Why? Because you only have a $10 per share gain, whereas some of your other shares might have a $30 per share gain, and so you'd pay much higher taxes. And that's the way it's been done for quite a while. The bill originally said, no, you just can't do it that way anymore, and neither can the fund managers, but the fund industry came in and raised a stink, and as a result, they got that taken out, which is good, but they left the individual investor in the position where you can't choose which shares. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Jeff, or Jake, whichever it is today.
This is Jeff, but you got to be really fast because I got 20 seconds left.
Hey, Jeff, let me just ask you quick. What do you see in the future for Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and if
okay.
President Trump deprivatizes